Good evening, listeners. It's June 3rd, and you're turned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It's currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Maggie Exton.
And I'm Kristen Finch. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU, or you're just interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about the awesome things happening at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we are joined by Kai Parker from the College of Engineering and the Department of Civil and Construction Engineering. So, Kai, what is your field of study within civil and construction engineering, and can you tell us a little bit about your research?
Most definitely. Hello, hello. My field within civil is coastal and ocean engineering, which was question number one. Question number two was, what do I do? Is that
yeah.
Okay. So, what I am interested in my research, and I guess in life as well, is trying to figure out how coastal hazards change through time, with a particular focus on things like flooding and things like climate change. That's the very fast answer to that question.
And so, so what does this research involve? What kind of data do you get to use, and what are you doing with the data?
Yeah, so it uses all kinds of observational information, things like buoys. We've got a great buoy network off the coast of entire United States. It uses atmospheric data. I work a lot with climate scientists, things like that. It's a really estuaries. I work a lot in estuaries are really interesting because they are really the combination of land, ocean, atmosphere. So I work with a lot of people from all over the place and use all kinds of data.
So how do you use the data? Do you do models or?
So I am a modeler, which... So unfortunately, I don't get to go out and collect the data that much. I get to hang out in a basement and use everyone else's data and then cry and be like, oh, look at all their beautiful pictures of them on a beach. Yes. So I'm a modeler and that's really, I kind of have to use models because I'm looking at the future and things that haven't happened yet. So we got to rely on our understanding of physics to try and be able to predict forward as well as what's happening now.
And so what kind of question or research question are you trying to answer with the models? And then what type of answer, like what is it, a certain quantity, a metric, or is what kind of answers do you get from the models?
Yes. The first question was...
What is the question that you're trying to solve with your model?
Yeah. Oh, cool. So... being in engineering, I'm really interested about the not just kind of science for science sake, but also how it interacts with humans. So the kind of questions that I'm interested in answering is, we know that the world is going to change. We know that the kind of the flood that we experience now is going to change through time. So how can we make decisions as communities to try and adapt and kind of mitigate the future flood, flood of the future, the hazards of the future. So I think a lot about like high water levels, extreme events and that sort, kind of buildings getting destroyed by erosion, things like that. So really the questions I'm interested in is what are the things that are going to harm humans and how can we interact with them to make the world work a little bit better? Yes. Question one.
All right. And then, so what comes out of the model? What number comes out, or is it one number? How would you explain the result to our listeners?
Yeah. So that's actually a great question because we have we really experimented a lot with the best way to present results to make it more more palatable to people, because a lot of times we'll come up with just a number for like extreme water level. And that doesn't really mean a lot to people. If I say that the water at this point is going to be 2 meters or something like that, it doesn't really register to a human brain. So we do a lot with like mapping, kind of making extreme flood maps and trying to make it more palatable to a community planner. I would say flood maps are kind of the main focus for me.
Okay. So it's explaining to folks if they are thinking about maybe building in a flood zone, or here's your probability of floods at this frequency, and then we expect this to increase in the future because of climate change, something like that?
Totally. That is definitely it. The probability is sometimes difficult, because I find that people have a hard time thinking in terms of probabilities a lot of times, and as well as in terms of uncertainty. So you have to be very, very careful how you present it and when you start going down that road. But it's important to go that road, because that's the way the world works. The world is full of uncertainty, and it's kind of dishonest to say that this is the answer.
Yeah.
Right, especially when you're trying to predict the future.
Yeah, try to predict the future, and of which we are the major one of the hardest things to predict. If you talk to climate modelers, they're trying to predict how human society is going to react to the knowledge of climate change. Are we going to actually stop putting carbon in the atmosphere, things like that? And who knows? Humans, I love that I work with water because it follows rules, but humans is like, oh, how would you possibly predict what a human's going to do?
So what are your approaches to modeling? So you're not just doing one result. You're saying you're getting a distribution of results and kind of the likelihood of them?
Yes. So I have kind of tried to tackle this problem from multiple different angles through my history, of which the first time I went after it, I ended up trying to do kind of what we call a deterministic approach, where you end up with like one future climate and you get a single answer for what flooding in the future is going to be. And I kind of hinted at that, foreshadowed a little bit before, that I find that a little bit problematic, in that there isn't one possible future. There's, an infinite number of possible futures based off us and based off the climate. There's a huge, the climate is a somewhat chaotic system. We can't predict what it's going to be like. And so recently what I've been doing is trying to get into the world of probabilistic modeling and say, there's say a 50% chance that your house will be in trouble in this position, depending on the way the world, way the dice roll in the world.
Yep. And so now you're, instead of just testing one scenario at a time and getting one answer, you're able to do combinations of all the variables and all the data that you have to come up with many scenarios and many answers.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm doing, something called a Monte Carlo simulation, which I love that term because it's just like, oh, we're gambling and trying to predict. Yeah. It's just like a casino, but, and so you're able to kind of consider the Monte Carlos. Oftentimes it's tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of different times you're running something. So you're trying to explore every possible thing that could happen, every possible wave climate, every possible direction the wind could blow.
Tens of thousands.
Yeah.
Wow.
Many, 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 many times. And for me, that's, I'm trying to do really long time records too. So 100 years simulations, tens of thousands of times. And you
do that all that on your computer in the basement?
No, I don't. My computer on the basement is actually horrible. I was, my girlfriend just got a new computer, and her new like laptop is significantly more powerful than my computer in my office. But I work a lot with a supercomputer that's in Texas called TAC, and it's part of the XSEED program, which is funded by NSF, and it provides supercomputing power to people who have cool ideas to try and look at the world. Which
very cool, yeah. We do that some in genomics too. We can like log into the big computers that do all the chugging data kind of in an abstract way.
Yeah.
So you just press that, you put in your code and press go, and then you come back and you check and see if it worked and look at your results.
Yeah, it's super cool. I love that that's a, and it's a cool, just a resource that I'm glad that we're as a society kind of focusing on that, and everyone can use it. Like,
yeah, that's great for accessibility. You don't need to spend like, I wouldn't even know how much that would cost. Millions? Is that the order that we're talking about? Millions of dollars?
Probably. Yeah. Mind-boggling amounts. Yeah, just to keep it cool, like, for all.
Yeah. Now, not every lab needs to have a computer to be able to do research. It's kind of like outsourcing, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. So you just were awarded a Fulbright scholarship.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you will be doing with your Fulbright scholarship and how that relates to your research here at Oregon State?
Most definitely. So the Fulbright, I will be going to Chile, to Valparaiso on the coast. And the research I'll be doing there, or at least that I proposed, is kind of using my work with probabilistic modeling here and trying to extend that to tsunami hazards, which is something that Chile is very interested in. They have a long history of battling tsunamis, and they want to kind of update their hazard, their quantification of the hazard, what kind of infrastructure is in trouble, as well as try and think about their, another thing we talked about is trying to integrate that into their real-time tsunami hazard system. Yeah, they want to be able to, have some kind of an alarm system so that when they see an earthquake goes off, tell people where they can go and how to be safe in real time.
So it'll be kind of, will you be bringing this model that you've been developing here at Oregon State with you to, and then kind of adapting it to the variables and the data that is available for Chile?
Yeah, so that's kind of a really cool thing. This is that Chile is very similar to our climate, very similar to our coastal system, just on the other side of the equator. So a lot of the stuff we think about here is equally applicable to them, including tsunamis. By chance, we also have a risk of a large tsunami as well. So it's trying to take, and the component that I'm taking with me is to do probabilistic modeling, you have to be able to simulate things really fast. As Maggie pointed out, it's a lot of processing power. And so I have been working on a way to try and make things run really quickly. And that's what they need for a real-time tsunami system.
Right. So like how much time between an earthquake and then the tsunami arrival? There's like 20, 30 minutes?
Yeah. So I'm not 100% sure on the... for Chile, how long they would have. I know that for here, it's something like that. Maybe even less time than that. Enough for you to run as fast as you can.
Right, yeah, get away.
Go for the highest spot.
Just running and not time to like get into your car or anything? You'd just like really be running?
So cars are problematic because it just takes one car stopping to just...
slow down the whole...
I was just in a traffic jam an hour ago. I was like, one car brought down the whole shebang. And when you've got 10 minutes to escape, if someone can't start their car, that's not good.
I see.
So how have you sped up this modeling tens of thousands of climates? What do you do to do that?
Yeah, so I use a technique that's called, it has a bunch of different names, but what I like to call it is emulation. It's also called like meta modeling and surrogate modeling, and it's got a whole bunch of different names. But the idea behind it is that it's a model, a very fast model of a model, and it, which sounds like a really horrible idea. Whenever I say that, people just go like, "What model of a model? Why would you do that?" But the easiest way I can think of to explain it is it's very similar to how our brain handles the world around us. And actually a way of doing it is with neural nets, which was designed off of our brains, trying to build a model that works like our brain does. But
neural networks, that was built off of the human brain as inspiration?
Kind of, yeah. Somewhat similarly. It's a stripped down, because we don't fully understand, I guess, how our brains work. Yeah. I guess I'm speculating now. I'm out of my range of expertise, but I do know that the ideal for neural nets came from how our brains organize things.
Okay.
So the idea of emulation, it's when our brain tries to think about something like catching a ball, it doesn't go through and do all of the math. For like tsunami. What we do now is we do all the math, and it takes a long time. Physics is complicated, and even catching a ball is a lot of math you have to do, and our brain doesn't have enough time to do that. So we then take a different path in evolutionary history, and we just use our past experiences to draw upon. So we've played catch throughout your childhood. And you know from your bank of experiences that you think the ball is going to be somewhere in this area because you've seen it before. And so I do that with really complex models, say a tsunami model. I play catch with the computer, run it at a bunch of design points. And then you can essentially just use that bank of experiences to very quickly predict what the model would say if you had run it. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, very cool. It's like, I keep trying to put it into, or I think of it as like the computer is learning, right?
Oh,
but
totally.
But it's not exactly like machine learning, or is it more like machine learning than I think?
It has a lot of parallels to machine learning for sure. And you can use a lot of the same algorithms. It's a slightly different like flavor to it, but a lot of machine learning algorithms can be used for this very thing.
Mm-hmm. So instead of running tens of thousands of models, like how many would you need to train it to get what you needed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my kind of in the context of flooding, it was in the scale of like hundreds, maybe 160, which is how many I ended up running. So that's like reasonable, still took a while, but is just tremendously a lot more efficient than.
Did you still have to use the Texas computers, or could you use your basement computer?
My basement computer. I actually used the basement computer. I went on vacation and just lined it up and it just chugged while I was up climbing. So it didn't matter if it was slow.
Yeah. Okay. So when does that Fulbright start? This year?
It's actually next year. So I'll start in March of next year.
And I want to remind the listeners that you are tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis, and we're broadcasting from the campus of Oregon State University. We're talking to Kai Parker from the College of Engineering, Department of Civil and what was it?
Construction.
Civil and Construction Engineering, right. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask, how did you get interested in engineering or this type of research in the first place, coastal, working on the coast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's I ask myself that sometimes because it didn't really make sense from where I started. I grew up in the middle of the desert where there was no coast in any direction as far as you could drive. And I ended up in engineering somewhat arbitrarily, really. I just kind of made a snap decision and ended up in actually environmental engineering. And then I decided I didn't like that. And I moved into civil engineering. I went to a school that didn't let you change majors very easily. Moved into civil engineering and then found out I didn't like that. And eventually took a class in coastal. And it was like, yes, this is something that I can like, that I'm really interested in. And then did an internship at a marine lab. That was Bodega Marine Lab, that is part of UC Davis, which is fantastic. And pretty much I ended up deciding to do it after that.
Sweet. And so what about coastal engineering really, like, I guess, made you excited from the perspective of someone who is in the environmental engineering or like civil engineering background.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's tremendously a lot cooler than concrete. I have to be careful. I think Maggie's a geotech, so I can't talk too bad about it.
Yeah, but I don't do concrete. I do soil. That's true. So.
Yeah. Soil is way better than concrete as well.
Yeah. And sand in particular, which is on a beach.
That's on a beach. Fair enough. I just love that it's just, for me, it just really jives a lot more with what interests me, how dynamic it is. It's a lot more concrete for me, and civil engineering was a lot of just kind of following code and things like that. I don't know if I ever got to the point where I was into doing research on it, where it was really engaging. And coastal stuff is just it's always changing. It's just really dynamic, and I love the ocean. It really associates with me, I guess.
It was kind of like a broader view than just concrete, and like, which if you're following code only has so many like possibilities really, and then you jump into this coastal thing. I would think if I was in your shoes at that time, I would have been waffling back and forth, like, you know, do I open this door to coastal engineering, which is so dynamic, like you're saying, and mm-hmm. involves all of these pieces, many unknowns. How was that just really exciting for you to kind of go toward that research?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, in some ways it was like it just kind of made my life make a lot more sense. I wasn't really, doing well in civil or like really succeeding. And so it was like, oh, this is something that I can actually see myself being in. And so I don't know if it was like really scary or anything like that. It was just like, okay, this is finally something I can actually see spending a lifetime on, which I'd never found before until then.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So do you want to continue with your climate research? Is that something or flood mapping, is that something you see yourself doing?
I would love to, but I also while here I've really gotten really interested in teaching as well, so that has kind of sidetracked me in a lot of ways, as well as potentially teaching as a full-time position. So I'm as always, I could do many things.
Yeah.
But those.
Have you TA'd for a lot of classes?
Yeah, I've done a lot of TAing, and I recently I've been working on the Oregon State has a cool program called the GCUT, which is awesome. If any of you all are thinking about it, I'll happily do a radio shout out for that. And it talks a lot about kind of the art and the science of teaching, which is something that is woefully ignored in the modern world, that we spend all this time researching these microscopic topics and forget that part of the whole reason why the main reason the university system exists is to teach people, and no one thinks at all about it. So I really enjoy that, thinking about the art and the science of teaching as well.
Yeah. And research. For those of you who don't know, GCUT stands for the Graduate Certificate in College and University Teaching.
Yeah.
Is that right? And it's through the graduate school. Mm-hmm. So yeah, check it out if you're mm-hmm. interested in teaching.
And what does that require to have this extra certification?
I think it's mainly just a mob of coursework. Of which there's classes on kind of learning theories, classes on kind of practical, kind of building a syllabus type stuff, writing, kind of philosophy of teaching. There's a couple of electives in there too. So it gets into, you can kind of customize it as well into what you're interested in.
Awesome. And so how was it, how did you... How did you approach, I guess this is a question just from personal experience, how do you approach your advisor and say, I want to add on this graduate teaching certificate mm-hmm. into my coursework? Were they supportive of that, or what was that kind of like a contentious issue? Because it's an extra load of courses, right?
Yeah, it's definitely, and I've heard of advisors who really have fought to get back against that. A lot of times advisors try and keep you out of coursework so they can get more research out of you. But me and I have a lot of autonomy with my advisor. And so I don't even know if I asked him, honestly, to tell you the truth. I think I just did it.
Awesome. Nice. And so you see yourself either staying in university teaching or potentially also continuing with research?
Yeah, kind of, those are the main directions, or yeah, probably something like that. Or I could get completely sidetracked and end up farming goats or something like that. Who knows?
They're so cute.
They're so cute. Baby goats. Enough to give up a career for baby goats.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. So what do you do when you're not teaching, you're not researching? What do you farm baby goats?
Yeah, that was, I realized that's a very weird phrase, farming baby yeah. goats. Goats do not grow, people. I don't want to have that rumor spreading.
Don't plant any don't baby plant, goats.
Yeah, don't plant them. Yeah, so the one reason I love Oregon State is there's so much beautiful things around here. So the main thing that makes me tick as a human is the outdoors. I love surfing. I love hiking. I recently have become really into climbing. So probably the last two summers, that's been my go-to is climbing rocks all over the state and beyond.
Nice. There's a lot of great climbing in Oregon.
Yeah. Don't tell anyone though. It's a secret. Everyone thinks it's horrible, but it's fantastic.
And so we're getting near the end of our time on Inspiration Dissemination this evening, but we want to know if you have any advice for us, advice for students who are thinking about graduate school or students who haven't chosen a major yet, but maybe are leaning towards something in engineering, or just general life advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the main advice that I can think of is don't let anyone tell you that you shouldn't be going into grad school, or that you're not good enough or don't let yourself convince yourself either that you're not capable of going to grad school, because I kind of at the start of my path, I really was not doing well at anything, and I just didn't know what I wanted to do. And I think it ended up working out. I feel like it is. So believe in yourself as a student and as a human, and it'll work out. Yeah. Most time does.
Yeah, I think it is, like, a lot of it is what you make of it, right?
Yeah.
So the resources are here, and it's you can drag yourself along.
Exactly. Well said from a pro right there. Drag yourself along.
I'm a fourth year, so a little bit cynical now about this. Anyway, we also asked you to provide a song for us.
And oh, yeah.
What was that song and why?
So I chose The Coasters because we were talking about coastal engineering. And then the song was Three Cool Cats because we are three cool cats in this awesome recording studio right now.
Boom.
Yeah, we are.
All right.
Thanks, Kai. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you too as well. It was great being here.
We'll be interested to see if the Kai Parker model can help us out at the Newport Coast.
Oh, yeah. We'll see.
for predicting the next big tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you're listening to Inspiration Dissemination on KBVR Corvallis. We're on every Sunday at 7 p.m. with a different graduate student. So tune in next week again, and we'll be back. And this episode is being recorded live, and it will become a podcast. So check us out on Apple Podcasts, Inspiration Dissemination. Thanks again, Kai.
And thank you.
And here's The Coasters.